This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. I'm your host, Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco, and I'm joined in studio today by the PG's Paul Zeiss and 93.7 The Fan weekend host John Phillips. On this week's show, we're going to take a look at the post-mortem of Super Bowl 45, Steelers lose to the Packers, the disappearing Penguins, and in our third segment, we take a quick look at Pitt football and basketball. And Paul, I'm going to get right started right here with the Steelers right away. Looking back, you know, what ultimately, I want to take one look back at the Super Bowl, what ultimately decided that game for you in your mind?
Well, I think it was just a combination of things. If you looked at the Steelers, you know, throughout their run into the through the playoffs and even this year, they always seem to get one or two game-changing plays from their defense, and Ben Roethlisberger always seemed to make one or two really late game-changing plays, and that didn't happen. I mean, people look at the turnovers, and, you know, you can point to turnovers in every game that they've played. They had the ball with 2 minutes left and a chance to win. Ultimately, and I'm sure you felt this way. I felt like, well, they're going to win this game just because that's the way they play. They look ugly sometimes. They don't, you know, they've had bad quarters here, bad quarters there. This time it just didn't happen. I just think they didn't get enough of those big plays from Troy Polamalu or Woodley or Harrison and Roethlisberger. And that was probably the difference in the game.
I think Aaron Rodgers had a lot to do with it, too. I mean, let's look at his play, 300 yards passing, 3 touchdowns, really no mistakes. His receivers dropped 5 or 6 passes on top of that. It could have been a lot worse, potentially. And, yeah, you're right, it did come to that down to that last drive. And we talked about this just a little while ago. A lot of confusion on that drive, which is a little concerning, you know, considering the, you know, somewhat veteran team. I know Wallace in his second year, you know, maybe not as experienced, but nonetheless, very confusing. It was disappointing, but I think Aaron Rodgers was probably the big difference.
Well, I'd like to take a minute here and bring in Ed Bouchette, who's the PG's Steelers beat writer and 93.7 The Fan, Steelers insider. Ed, thanks for taking a minute to join us here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jerry.
You know, we can look back at the Super Bowl, but I want to ask you a question looking a little bit forward, Ed. Is it going to be tough for Kevin Colbert to keep this team together? They've got some free agents. Are they going to be able to – let's assume there's going to be labor peace at some point. Is he going to be able to keep this team together pretty much the way you see it now?
Jerry, you know, every year there's free agents, and, you know, so this is no different. In fact, they don't have that many. Willie Colon, you know, who didn't play the whole year, Lamar Woodley, and Ike Taylor are the main ones. So I don't think he's going to be able to keep all three. I keep thinking that Lamar Woodley's going to be the guy who leaves. The 30% rule still applies. So they can't really sign him to a long-term deal before March 4th. The only thing they can do is put the franchise tag on him, and that's over $10 million to pay him this year. So, I don't know. I just keep saying he's the one that I think can leave. And they drafted Jason Worlds last year in the second round, linebacker from Virginia Tech, actually defensive end. They're converting to outside linebacker. And he's shown some spunk on special teams. And, you know, maybe he'll be the starting left outside linebacker next season.
So you think it's going to be – I mean, Woodley, I guess, what's – can you, I mean, educate me a little bit. The 30% rule is what?
Well, he had a 550,000, I think, somewhere around there, Jerry, salary this year, and they cannot increase his salary more than 30% over that each year. Like, you know, I'm sorry, 5, 10, 15. So that's roughly $160,000. More they can give him next year, and then 30% over that the following year. So everything would have to be in a signing bonus, and the kind of money he's looking for, Jerry, which would be more than James Harrison.
Probably. Yeah, I was
gonna
say.
Harrison got $50 million, so they're gonna have to give him $40 million in signing bonus, and that just ain't gonna happen.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not gonna happen.
Now those rules will change. Once there's a new CBA, that 30% rule is going to be out. That was just a poison pill that both sides put in to try and, you know, keep the CBA rolling, and it didn't work. But, you know, once he becomes a free agent now, you're really dealing with other teams making him an offer.
Right.
You know, Ed, if you take the salary considerations out of it, I mean, who would you say of those three is the most valuable or the one that they really can't afford to lose based on their roster and what they do and what they need?
Ike Taylor. I mean, they have no cornerbacks. I don't think that I'm, you know, letting anybody in on anything. I think their second-best corner right now is William Gay, but you remove Ike Taylor from that, and you're looking at Gay and McFadden as your starting cornerbacks next year, maybe Cresden Butler and Keenan Lewis is your next two, unless you pick somebody else up. And you're not going to pick anybody else good up in free agency. You know, that's a catch-22. Either they want so much money that you can't afford them, or they're affordable because they're not good enough. The only other way to get them is a draft.
What will they do to maybe improve that offensive line? I mean, are they, again, going through the draft, is there anybody maybe in free agency that they can look at? I guess it's going to be that, of course, be based on, you know, labor piece and how much more money they're going to get to play with in terms of paying players.
John, once again, what you're looking at is if you want to improve your line through free agency, it's going to cost you a bundle, or you're going to get guys like Jonathan Scott. Okay, so assuming Max Starks comes back healthy and they can sign Willie Colon, and I think they can sign Willie Colon, you've got your starting two tackles back. You have to make a decision. Do you want Flozo Adams back a year older and $5 million to pay him this year? The interior, I think, is fine. I think you can see Doug Legursky competing for a spot guard. You have your Pro Bowl center and Chris Kimoyatu at left guard. So I'm not worried about the interior. I think they could have some problems with tackles, especially if Colon and Starks either aren't healthy enough or Colon doesn't come back.
We're speaking with Post-Gazette Steelers beat writer Ed Boucher, who's also 93.7 The Fan Steeler Insider. Ed, let's talk about labor and the NFL.
One of my favorite topics,
yeah,
Jerry.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's going to be, I guess, for for all of us for at least a while longer. Ed, they were going to have 2 days of talks. They only wound up having one and broke them off. Is that a sign that March 4th is going to come and go without an agreement?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a little doubt, Jerry. I mean, that was if you're looking for a midnight resolution to this, 11th hour, if you will, resolution to this, as they had the last time they struck an agreement that then the owners decided not that they couldn't live with. Everybody's fooling themselves because the NFL took one look at how far apart they were and says, we're too far apart, we're not going to talk. So it sounds like they're digging in their heels, and I put it all on the owners this time, Jerry. I think they're not smart enough to get together among themselves, and that's part of the whole problem. It's not with the players, it's among themselves, and they want the players to solve their inner problems that the owners are having among themselves, and players aren't going to do it.
And as part of that problem, just is it? I mean, it all revolves around money, I'm sure.
There's how they share money is becoming less and less. You know, the NFL was this great league that shared all these revenues. Well, the revenues aren't getting shared anymore. You have televisions get shared. And attendance, ticket money's getting shared. But all that other revenue that's around teams that you see, from luxury boxes and all that other stuff, it's not getting shared. And there are teams that just are rich, like Dallas, although after seeing that building and seeing how much he's losing, maybe he won't be rich much longer, and Washington and New England. Compared with the Jacksonvilles of the world and Cincinnati's, there's not that kind of revenue. You know, there's not that local revenue, radio rights, and stuff that they have in New York that they don't have in Cincinnati and Pittsburgh.
And I want to touch. You mentioned the stadium down there, and I want to touch on one thing that's been in the news lately about the game, about the ticket problem they had down there. How much of a black eye is that for the NFL? I mean, are people going to say, it's 400 people, so what? I just thought that it was so terribly handled. It seems like the league sometimes they can't get out of its own way. And to me, that's part of the tenure of Roger Goodell. And I happen to like him in a lot of ways. I think he gets out in front of things, and I think he's not afraid to confront. But, you know, you talk about internal owner squabbling, but it seems like the NFL sometimes can't get out of its own way on things.
Yeah, but except, you know, Roger now seems like he's fiddling while his league burns. You know, I mean, he mm-hmm. just stood up in front of everybody on Friday and had the audacity to tell them how Dallas was handling everything correctly and everything's fine, nothing's been canceled, and I kept getting press releases from his very league PR people, all the list of events that were being canceled in Dallas because of the weather. And then to just allow those poor people to go to a game thinking they had seats right up to the time, you know, they took them before the scanner and then they wouldn't scan, and then how they treated them, Jerry, shuffling them off and, you know, just not treating them with respect. I hope the NFL gets it shoved up its butt as much as it can in this issue.
Well, and like I say, they can't get out of their own way, Ed. I don't know if they can. That was just stupid. I mean, it really was. I mean, the league prides itself on being smart and slick and
arrogant.
The number one league,
arrogant.
Well, and arrogant too. Yeah, I mean, and they are. When you're the best, you can be. But I think that, you know, it that was just terrible, so shabby. And I think it was just kind of an ending to a Super Bowl that seemed kind of ragged and a little bit, I don't know, and sometimes surreal. Don't you think?
Yeah, it was a mess. The whole thing was a mess. The gaudiness of that stadium and the ego to try and break a record, an attendance record in the Super Bowl, and what they tried to do, it turns people off. I don't know that the NFL can even go about doing so many things wrong that they can turn enough people off to make the sport less popular, but there certainly looks like they're trying, Jerry. And this labor situation isn't going to help it.
Yeah, I agree, Ed. It's going to be tough. Ed, hey, thanks for taking the time to join us today on the roundtable. And
right,
see you,
Jerry,
down the road.
Thank you.
All right. That was Ed Bouchette of the Post-Gazette, Steelers beat writer, and 93.7 The Fan Steelers Insider. Up next, we talk Penguins. This is the roundtable on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back. I'm Jerry Mikko, and I'm in studio with the PG's Paul Zeiss and 93.7 The Fan weekend host John Phillips. Guys, time to take a little look at the Penguins here, who lost to Columbus on Tuesday 4-1 in a loss I thought was sloppy. I don't think it took care of a lot. And then on Thursday night played, I thought, a great game against the Kings. Did what they had to do with what looked like a roster that was half full of guys from Wilkes-Barre, but a great game by Marc-Andre Fleury, and got it out a 2-1 win. You know, what this team is going to have to rely. I think that the key to this team from here on out, at least until they get Sidney Crosby back, is Marc-Andre Fleury. John, I mean, is that the guy they're going to like look to as the pivot?
Yeah, I mean, defensively, they're going to have to be really tight. I mean, they lost Dustin Jeffrey again, another forward, the fourth center they've lost, I think, this year. Mm-hmm. You know, scoring is going to be at a premium, and so Fleury will have an opportunity to maybe silence any other critics that he might have by, you know, being a wall. And so low-scoring games the other night, 2-1 against the Kings. Fleury's going to have to be a guy that will have to, you know, provide them with, you know, big stops and you know, get the goals where they can from whoever they have. And like you said, it's like having Wilkes-Barre up here with the mm-hmm. with the main team, and that's what they're going to need. These young guys are going to get a chance to, you know, prove themselves and, you know, put a few pucks in the back of the net.
Maybe they gave them a little bit of jump last night too, the young guys. Maybe.
Yep.
I don't know.
Well, isn't it interesting too, like at the beginning of the year, and, you know, within the first 10 games or so, there were people in this town ready to run Marc-Andre Fleury out of town. There were people talking about, you know, starting Brent Johnson and all these other things. And here, come to the end of the season, or the midseason at least, I mean, if he continues to play the way he's played, you can make a strong case that he's been their MVP this year. But just because of all the things that have happened, he's held them in a lot of games where they just can't score goals. And you know, like Thursday night, they slop one in with mm-hmm. 15 seconds left in overtime and win. I think he's been really tremendous in a lot of ways over the last month and a half. And if he continues to play like that, they're gonna be able to win enough games to get a good seed. And then you hope Sidney Crosby gets back, and maybe the addition of him with the way they're playing defense, and now they're poised to make another run.
Certainly they are. I mean, they're right now they're fourth in the conference. Guys, I'm going to bring in Dave Molinari, the PG. Penguins beat writer. Dave, thanks for taking the time to join us here on the roundtable.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
You know, I want to change up a little bit here and ask you about the Matt Cook situation, and then that the penalty he was given, a 4-game suspension for the hit on Tootin the other night against Columbus. Dave, you've covered a lot of hockey, and you know a lot, and you cover the league, and you see a lot of games. Is this part of it, Dave? Is this part of it, Matt Cook's reputation, or is this a little bit excessive? Was this just a little bit too much, maybe?
His reputation certainly was taken into account with the suspension that he got, but the league makes no bones about doing that. When you're a repeat offender, as Matt Cook is, the league is going to come down harder on you than it would be on a guy who was guilty of that kind of offense for the first time. So, the punishment might have come across as a bit harsh, but I think the league is obviously concluded that if it wants to deter Matt Cook from doing things like that in the future, it has to come down hard on him.
So in this sense, Dave, it's like they're being consistent because Matt Cook obviously has a track record. So the punishment is consistent with a guy who has a track record.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of unhappiness with the apparent inconsistency in discipline as it's or supplemental discipline as it's meted out by Colin Campbell of the NHL. So, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush here, but in the case of Matt Cook, when you consider his status as a repeat offender and a guy who has earned his reputation for cheap shots, I don't think 4 games was out of line at all.
Dave, is it safe to say he's not going to change his style of play anytime soon?
There's certainly no indication that he will. And really, they don't want him to change his style. I mean, if Matt Cook stops hitting people, stops being physical and playing with an edge, he's not going to be nearly as valuable as he is now. But he has to make some better decisions. When you're preparing to hit a guy and you see his numbers, you just can't follow through with your hit. You're just asking for at least a penalty and in some cases a fine and or a suspension. Certainly it's a lot easier to say what decision should be made when you're watching from the press box or you're watching on television. But these guys are pros and they're paid, being able to make split-second decisions on the ice is part of what they're paid for, and I think Matt Cook is capable of making better decisions.
Now, having said all of that, if he's going to serve his suspension, he's going to come back. Let's say he goes out in a few more games, does something again. Is that going to open up Penguin players to retaliation? I mean, they're already depleted as it is offensively. Is that something that might concern you, or do you think that concerns the team?
Well, it wouldn't concern me unless somebody would decide to retaliate against the Pittsburgh Riders.
I guess that's true, yeah.
But, I if there's going to be retaliation, it's going to be in a game in which an incident occurs. You know, if Matt Cook would do something in his first game back against Chicago on the 20th of this month, I don't think that when they play Washington the next night that one of the Capitals would be looking to avenge whatever it is that that Cook did. So, I think there's a much more concern about losing a guy like Matt Cook again because of an outside the lines incident than there is of losing a player in a retaliation by an opponent.
Dave, sort of along those lines of players being out and whatnot, my question for you is, how long do you think the Penguins can continue to sort of piece this together, that with Sidney Crosby out, with Malkin out, with all the other guys out? They've sort of done it a little bit with smoke and mirrors, and you would think at some point it's going to start to show up. But, I mean, can this team be this resourceful for another month if they have to, or 5-6 weeks?
Well, they really haven't done it with smoke and mirrors. They've done it with good goaltending, generally conscientious defensive play, and some pretty decent special teams, especially penalty killing. They're going to have to be able to get by in low-scoring games, win a lot of 2-1s and 3-2s and that sort of thing. But they've proven capable of doing that. Certainly goals are going to be much tougher to come by. I mean, at the moment they have seven guys on injured reserve, which, and you could take those seven guys and have the foundation of a pretty good franchise. They're certainly not the team they're capable of being at the moment, but they are capable of staying competitive and keeping their heads above water until they get reasonably healthy, assuming that happens at some point in this decade, which right now, I wouldn't want to take anything for granted with the way guys are dropping.
Dave, one of the unknowns, we're talking with Dave Molinari, the Penguins beat writer for the Post-Gazette. Dave, one of the unknowns, of course, is Sidney Crosby's concussion and when he'll be back. If you're Ray Sherro, obviously he's got to be talking to some people. What would he be trying to do? Would he be trying to bring in a winger? Would he be looking for a center? Who's out there, Dave, that they could realistically get? I know they've got a little bit of money now under the cap because of Malkin's injury.
Yeah, right now it looks like as they get closer to the trade deadline, the salary cap space they have available changes day to day, depending on who gets brought up, who gets sent down, that sort of thing. But right now it looks as if they'll have something in the neighborhood of $8 million worth of full season contracts that they could add by the deadline on February 28th. Right now, I don't think there's any particular urgency to bring in a center. They're pretty strong down the middle, and they have all of their people healthy. Obviously, they're particularly hard hit down the middle right now with Crosby, Malkin, Letestu, and Jeffrey out. But they expect to get three of those four guys back this season. And when you add Jordan Staal, it would be kind of silly to make a short-term pickup for somebody to play in the middle. I expect them to focus their efforts on trying to get a winger or two who can score some goals. That's been an obvious need for several years now. And right now, at this point, it's still a little early to say exactly who's on the market because you have a couple of weeks until we get to the deadline. And right now, teams that aren't necessarily interested in being sellers might well be a week or 10 days from now when they conclude that they're not going to be able to contend for a playoff spot after all. So right now, that trade pool is kind of small, but it will be expanding. And Ray Shiro's track record is that he generally doesn't make a move until a week before the deadline and often until a few minutes before the deadline. So I don't expect anything imminent, but I certainly do expect him to do something. And if I had to guess at this point, I would say it will be that he'll make a move for a winger who can score some goals.
Dave, what's the level of frustration? And it's not at Sidney Crosby, but just the whole situation with Sid. I mean, I know he sounded very frustrated yesterday too, but kind of resigned at the same time that, hey, this is one of those things you have to wait out. But how frustrating is it for these guys to go through this?
Well, actually, I think he's almost an out of sight, out of mind issue for them right now. Hockey teams, I can't really speak to players in other sports, but in hockey, if you're not playing, you're not really at the forefront of your teammates' thoughts. Their focus is on trying to do the most they can with whichever 20 guys they're able to send out on a particular night. So you really don't hear the Penguins talk much about Sidney Crosby or any of the other injured guys unless they're asked about them. And that's probably if they stopped and really focused on all the guys they're missing, it would probably be pretty bad for their psyche. So they're probably better off on just worrying about the guys that they can see at the rink day in and day out.
Well, they're a mass unit on ice right now. Dave, thanks a lot for taking the time to join us here on the Roundtable.
Oh, it's my pleasure, guys.
Dave Molinari, Penguins beat writer for the Post-Gazette. Up next, we talk Pitt hoops and football. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jerry Micco, and joining me in studio today are the PG's Paul Zeiss and Fan Weekend host John Phillips. Paul, I'm going to start with you. Pitt goes to Villanova tonight, and that's going to be a huge game for them in the Big East. Villanova always tough. Is this going to be a kind of tough game for Pitt to win? They don't have Ashton Gibbs, and Villanova's got good guards.
This could be really a game where the lack of having Ashton Gibbs out there, it really shows up a little bit with Pitt. I think one of the biggest problems that they're going to have is it's not that easy to drive to the basket against Villanova. They were able to do it against West Virginia because that's an area that, West Virginia has some matchup problems defensively, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But my point is, in this game, they're going to have to hit some outside shots. So whether it's Gilbert Brown or, Wanamaker, I suppose, Trevon Woodall, maybe J.J. Moore comes in and hits a few. They're going to have to get some baskets from the three-point line because Villanova is going to hit threes. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to match some of the scoring that Villanova does. I think it's going to be a very, very tough spot, especially since Villanova's coming off that heartbreaking loss the other night.
They're
going
to
be ready to play.
This.
And one other thing, I think on that on-campus facility, I don't know what the name of it is, where they're playing this game tonight, Villanova's won like about 45 in a row. They've lost some quote-unquote home games at the Spectrum or at the New Spectrum, whatever it's called down in Philadelphia. But at that on-campus facility, they rarely ever lose. So it's a very tough spot for Pitt, even with Ashton Gibbs.
Here's the good news. Even if they do lose this game, they're still going to be in sole possession of first place.
They're
in the
like two or three games in first place.
And that's the thing. They've created a little bit of separation, not a whole lot, but enough that, you're going to lose a couple games in the Big East. Who could conceivably imagine any team running an 18-game or 20-game gauntlet in a regular season, plus going into a Big East tournament? I think they'll be fine even if they end up losing this game. They get South Florida coming back, and then is it West Virginia, another game right after that. So I think they'll be fine. They've got seniors that they can lean on. Can they match that outside scoring? We'll see. But grind it out defensively, maybe keep the game in the 50s and 60s and hope for the best.
Well, they've got South Florida next. South Florida's an improved team, but I don't think Pitt – South Florida is one of those tricky games. If you go to Villanova and you lose that game, is this one of these games that Pitt better be ready to play because it's a Big East game and it's South Florida? Kind of forget about South Florida, but they can be tricky.
Well, what's interesting about South Florida is if you watch them play, they look almost right now like Pitt did in Ben Howland's first year, a team that really plays extremely hard and forces you to try and beat them because they're not, they just don't have enough players. They really don't. I watched them play against Marquette on TV the other night. They were up, 17, 18 points in that game, and they just ran out of gas. But they played hard, and Marquette, pushed them to the brink, and they'll do that to Pitt. I just don't know that they have enough. They're going to pick somebody off going down the stretch, South Florida. They are. It's a team that plays like that, that comes to play hard every single night. Sooner or later, they're going to be able to just get over the top. It's not going to be an easy game for Pitt, but I would be shocked if they lose it because they don't usually lose
especially
those kind
at
of
the
games. Pete. Yeah, they usually don't lose those kind of games, Right. Although a few years ago they did lose to Seton Hall, and then they also lose to Rutgers a couple of years ago too. I think so. Every so often they have one of those stinkers down the stretch.
I know they've got a bunch of seniors and they're 21-2 or 22-2. But has this been Jamie Dixon's best year? Maybe
I think so. No, well, wait a minute. I would say last year might have been.
Last year
might have been. This year they were expected to do very well in the Big East.
Yeah. There was a lot of people that picked them to be a Final Four team this year. Because of their, basically they got, I think 9 out of their top 10 players back from last year's team, which won, 28 games or something? So,
this year, you look at this year's team and you look at what they've done. And they're 10-1 in the Big East? I think they've only got one loss.
Right.
Notre Dame's second, and I think they have 3 losses.
Right.
So they've got a couple-game lead there on Notre Dame. Always seems to rope-a-dope them into a loss every year. It's amazing. But is this team, are they a number one seed? Let's say they lose 2 or 3 regular season games. They get to maybe the final of the Big East tournament. Don't have to win it. If you're the selection committee, do you give them a number one seed?
Well, I mean, they definitely have the RPI and all that other stuff. And you know what? The win against Texas is really starting to look like a very, very quality win.
By the way, I think Georgetown has a higher RPI than Pitt.
Well,
but that's only one thing they use. Well, I believe they do.
I mean, you know, I think the Big East has, what, 7 teams in the top 15 of the RPI? So it's possible. But, you know, the win over Texas, I think, in the non-conference, I think, was this the year they also beat Maryland?
Yes.
That's the other team they played? Yes. Maryland's right now kind of a bubble team, but they could get into the tournament, too. I think they're a number one. So if you go 19, if you go, say they go, what, 15-3, which is possible in the Big East.
Right.
I don't see how you're not a number one seed, especially when you look around the country. There's a lot of teams losing games. I think Duke's probably maybe a number one.
Kansas.
I think Texas is making a case right now.
Ohio State,
one.
Obviously.
Ohio State, obviously. You know, there's a few, but
a one seed out west, maybe. You talk about where they're going to end up in the brackets.
Well, no, I'm not asking that. Yeah. I'm asking if they can be a number one seed. But there's the automatic thing. Here's the Big East, which is loaded. Right, I mean, arguably, it's still the best conference this year, even though Ohio State's undefeated. And the Big Ten is not none of these conferences are pushover conferences. Right. Sure. But the Big East is the Big East. If Pitt is the number one seed out of the Big East, is the best the Big East seeds they get a one. Why would they move them? This came up the other day. Somebody said they'll be a number one out west, John. They said just what you said.
Okay.
Why would they then move Pitt? Why not keep Pitt in the South or the East or whatever?
Well, I can if Ohio State.
They're going to be one in the Midwest.
If they're one in the Midwest, and Duke, you know, I guess
one in the South.
One in the South.
Kansas.
You know, I guess Texas. Pitt wouldn't have to move then.
Maybe not.
But a lot of people think that Pitt will be a one, but they'll have to move. Which, if the Big East is the best conference in the country, why would you move the Big East?
Especially what are the regions are what? East, Southeast,
East, South,
Midwest,
East, Southeast, Midwest,
and
West.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe the Midwest number one is. Here's the thing: if they determine that maybe Pitt is the number three. Seed overall.
Right.
Maybe they give Kansas the one in the Midwest and Ohio State the one in the East, and then that makes Pitt move.
That makes
Pitt
move.
If Ohio State's the number
Duke's
one
not
seed
moving.
Overall.
No. Duke probably won't move.
No, Duke ain't moving.
Duke's not moving. You know, Ohio State's not moving.
It's gonna be an interesting tournament because while I think the field is better than last year's field, it's still not a field where there's three or four really dominant type teams. So a lot of teams could win.
It's probably a little more balanced when you say, Paul, a little deeper.
Deeper is a great way to say that this last year I thought last year's teams all of them were flawed. I didn't like hardly any of those teams from last year, and it proved when we had Butler, Michigan State without Kalen Lucas, West Virginia in the Final Four. I mean, no disrespect, but I mean, three or four years ago, you know, I think I wrote an article about it. Three or four years ago, we have North Carolina against Illinois with like 8 lottery picks on the floor. Yeah. You know.
I mean, that's the magic of the tournament, though. I mean, that's the great thing about it. I mean, a great team may run into a team that's just got their number, and that's just how it works.
That is how it works. I just think when I think of this team, I think that they could be a number one, very well could be number one seed. I think they could win the Big East tournament unless they play Notre Dame. Notre Dame just sends a rope-a-dope these guys like crazy. I'm going to pivot away from this basketball. I'm going to pivot. See. I want to go to football because, Paul, I got you on the show, so I want to talk to you about football real quick. And John, of course. National Signing Day's come and gone. The 2011 class is ranked in the middle of the pack. That was to be expected. But, you know, what do you make of Todd Graham's first class? How's he – I mean, he got a late start. He had to put things together.
I think two things that stood out to me. One, it's clear that he's going to tap into Texas and Louisiana, all that, and speed is, you know, going to be, as he said at his press conferences, speed is at a premium. And and like I said several times in interviews about this, you know, I don't know if any of these guys can play a lick, but a lot of them can run. And so that's the start. The second thing that I thought was maybe a little bit troubling was of those six guys they were waiting for on that last day, six guys that they said these are – you know, five of them local. Only one of them came to Pitt. And in order to get him to come to Pitt, they had to offer his cousin and give him, you know, a scholarship, a kid who's not eligible and really not probably a Division I player. That's alarming.
I'm excited to see what he can do in his first year because the recruiting class next year in Western PA, very big, Rochelle Shell, obviously the big kid there. If he can win 8, 9 games, 10 games, win the Big East – he's going to tap into more local talent, but I do like him going to Texas. I like they got six players from Florida as well. Continue that recruiting, and hopefully the talent will form.
Well, you got to give the guy a chance. I mean, he's not even had a chance at this point to do much. But it seems like they, you know, Paul, you mentioned the six guys that were out, and they only got one local guy. Western Pennsylvania actually next year will have some depth to their recruiting. Yeah. It'll actually be a good, there'll be team colleges in here recruiting even more.
By the way, Penn State, not a single Western Pennsylvania player in their recruiting class. I was stunned by that.
Well, maybe they were worried that Tom Bradley was going to get a job somewhere, but he didn't. He's still at Penn State. All right, next up, I'm going to read some fan mail here on the Post-Gazette Roundtable on 93.7 The Fan.
You're listening to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. It's time for fan mail on the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Roundtable here on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan, where it's time for our final segment that we call fan mail. A reminder, if you'd like me to read your email on the air, please send it to me at jmicko@post-gazette.com. We'll consider it for a future show. Please put the word roundtable in the subject line. Our fan mail this week's from Debbie, who writes, I'm just here to say thanks to the guys in black and gold for a great season. We're a bit spoiled here in Pittsburgh. We've become accustomed to winning, especially Super Bowls, so maybe losing is a bit harder to take for us than most. I want to thank the Steelers for a great run with two absolutely wonderful playoff games that were a blast to attend. Given the start to the season, who would have imagined even getting to the playoffs? Well, Debbie, I agree. I think that given the start and playing the first four games without Ben Roethlisberger, who was suspended for off-field incidents last March in Milledgeville, Georgia, I don't think a lot of people thought the Steelers would get this far. I think in that sense it was a successful season. I thought the Steelers would be 9-7 at best. And said so in my weekly chats. I do at postgazette.com. But I think they were above all expectation this year, winning the games they did, getting as far as they did, certainly. And no shame in losing to the Packers. The Packers are a good football team with a good defense. They remind you a lot of the Steelers in a lot of ways when you watch them play. But I think one thing that I was not surprised by, but maybe mildly surprised by all week, and when I got back from Dallas, I got back into the office on Tuesday, and I was looking at all the mail that was coming in, the emails from readers of the paper, and I can't tell you how many sounded just like Debbie's, thanking the team for a great season. It was a great run. This is a town that's used to winning, and when it goes to a Super Bowl, it's used to winning. It's only lost one in seven tries before they lost last Sunday against Dallas, or in Dallas against Green Bay. So this is a team that's used to winning. It's a team, a city that's used to having bringing home football champions, and they didn't. But I thought the reaction by the fans, by and large, was very pleasing. They thanked the team for having a great year. You didn't see a lot of emails. Of course, there were a few calling for firing of Bruce Arians or Mike Tomlin or whatever. And I think that says a lot about Pittsburgh people, and it says a lot about Pittsburgh fans that, hey, fans here appreciate a good effort. The Steelers gave them above and beyond a good effort this year. Whether they can do that again in 2011, we'll see. But certainly there's no crime in getting all the way to a Super Bowl, considering you didn't have your franchise quarterback for the first four games of the season. That does it for today's Post-Gazette Roundtable. I'd like to thank today's panel, Fan Weekend host John Phillips and the PG's Paul Zeiss, and our guests, both from the Post-Gazette, Ed Bouchette and Dave Molinari. Also, many thanks to our producer, Matt Popchuk, for the job he does for us every show. And I hope you'll join us on the Roundtable next Saturday morning on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.